It's the CougarFan.com Rise and Shout Podcast, episode 410. Get all of your BYU sports news at CougarFan.com. In this episode, my brother Matt and I talk about, well, we answer your tweet bag questions, including discussing The Last Dance and a little bit about Taysom Hill getting the money, getting paid. But before that, I talk with Matt Brown, formerly of SB Nation, now of the Extra Points newsletter, and we talk about how COVID-19 is shaping the upcoming sports year, and specifically, we start talking about how he thinks the scenarios might break out for a college football season.
Yeah, so from asking around, I think it's fair to say that just about everything is on the table right now. And if you are a university president or an athletic director or anybody that has any power in this decision-making process, you want to absolutely move heaven and earth to make sure a football season happens, particularly for some of these larger, you know, Power Five kind of schools, because so much of your athletic budget is tied in completely with football. If you don't have a football season, you don't get football broadcasting money. You don't get to charge $30 for parking. You have to refund some of these athletic donations. You can't charge $9 for a beer. And that pays the bills for almost everything. You can handle losing an NCAA tournament check. Some of these schools have actually made a little bit of money by not having spring sports. Football is the straw that stirs the drink. And so they're very motivated to have it. But a lot of the people that are being asked about this right now are not the people that ultimately will make that decision. So and what I tell people here who are following all this is, when somebody asks a coach when they think football will come back or how they think football should come back, like, it's fine to ask their opinion, but they have absolutely no decision-making power in here. And the athletic director, honestly, has very little too. The people that are going to ultimately decide when we can have mass gatherings again are going to be university presidents, who by and large are going to be very reticent to have football if you cannot have fans, because they are right now arguing in court that this is an amateur enterprise and that the people who are playing college football are regular students. And if you're bringing them on campus and having them play a game that requires them to repeatedly be in physical contact with each other, and a game where even no fans, there's still going to be 400 people in that stadium.
Well, but here's but Matt, that's the thing. Isn't this – I mean, in the end – the smartest thing to do, if they weren't associated, if you didn't have this amateur thing hanging over their head, right, is to do a plan like Major League Baseball is talking about, like the NFL is talking about, where you would just have it in front of empty stadiums and testing protocols and all that other stuff. But they can't do that, right? Because if they don't have the rest of the students on campus, your whole amateur argument disappears, doesn't it?
If you completely. I mean, it's already kind of shaky right now, but for Major League Baseball, you can do that, and you can get those players to sign up for absorbing that risk, because they have a collectively bargained agreement and they make a gajillion dollars. And yeah, college athletes don't have that opportunity. They don't have a CBA. They don't have, you know, it's not really clear what happens to them if somebody tests positive, or, you know, how it'll be safe for them. If you're a defensive tackle, you're breathing on somebody across the line of scrimmage for 2 hours. Like, there's no way to like limit the transmission there, just because the C deck is empty. So what I can tell you right now is that a bunch of FBS, you know, Power Five university presidents, and you're going to see this more over the next 2 weeks, are telling donors and are telling the press, we are planning on having in-person instruction next year. We're going to differentiate things. We might not open up all of our biggest lecture halls, but we're planning on being on campus. And I think you're going to see some sports reporters say, like, hey, you know, this is a positive sign for football. The truth is, like, nobody can really say for sure at this point. You can plan for campus instruction, but if your governor says, hey, you can't have mass gatherings of over 20 people, you're not opening campus back up. If you don't have liability insurance and the financial reserves for everybody, you're not opening campus back up. So we might see a delayed football season. We might see, as Bob Bowlesby pitched yesterday, a split season where some games are in the fall and some games are in the spring. We might see games in the spring. The only thing I feel comfortable predicting is that every option will be exhausted before football is unilaterally canceled, because that would mean just universal financial catastrophe. But I think the odds of football starting on time, as scheduled, as set up, are very low.
The question I had, Matt, is it started with, you know, in March Madness, it seemed to start like the avalanche began when a couple university presidents in the ACC, at least if you believe the story as it was told, that they basically said, our teams are not participating in this, finishing this tournament. So, I mean, is it that simple? If they come up with a plan, can one university president in the ACC who doesn't really care about football anyway and maybe is not the best economist in the world just says, no, my team's not playing this year? I mean,
it's entirely possible. And one of the big concerns right now is that we don't have as strong national, you know, not to get super political here, but like the national leadership in dealing with this hasn't really been there. So states are doing rapidly different decisions. What's happening right now in Illinois with where I live, where our restrictions and what's allowed right now and the kind of travel that's allowed versus what's happening in Georgia or Texas is very different. And some of these conferences are going to span geographies where you're going to have some governors that are going to lean towards a more open policy and some that are going to be more conservative about opening things up. And that's what conference commissioners are really worried about. I would not be at all surprised if whenever football starts, all 130 teams decide are not participating, whether because of state, you know, saying they can't do it, or, you know, in the case of like a UConn or New Mexico State, it might not be financially viable to have a football season. If we're doing a truncated season and you're losing your body bag games, you know, the game where you go to Auburn and get paid $1.7 million and the only thing left on your schedule is long trips in front of 9,000 fans, what's the point?
Yeah. So like that's
why I think this proposal about that I've seen a couple times on the internet about BYU just playing other independent teams, I don't think that's realistic at all, because I think that probably wouldn't be a financially viable move for BYU, and I would strongly suspect at least one of those independent teams would decide it's not worth it to have a season if that's what they're doing.
Well, I can't imagine UMass could even pull that off financially, right? I don't know enough about their finances, but I can't imagine without some of those other games on their schedule they could make it work. But the other piece to me from the fall is, so, you know, I've seen these numbers out there and they throw them around and you may have a better feel for it, but numbers like, well, 75% of university football revenue comes from tickets and game day activities, 25% from TV. I don't know if those numbers are accurate, but is that general direction true? I mean, MLB, NBA, NFL, they get a majority of their revenue from television, right? They get a big chunk from other stuff, but they still get, you know, college athletics, it's a little different, especially depending on who you are on the food chain. So how does that affect all this?
Yeah, I saw the Darren Revelle tweet, and it's not really accurate. And it's hard to generalize entirely because a lot of this just depends on what kind of television contract you are. Like if you're a Conference USA team, you make the majority of your money from the school itself. You're getting way more money from student fees, from state appropriations, and from university checks than you are from any external source. And your television revenue is really modest. I think it's off the top of my head, I think a Conference USA team makes about $500,000 a year. From broadcasting, and your total budget might be around $30 million, $35 million.
I mean, so it's crazy, right?
Yeah, you're really not making very much. If you're Ohio State, you're getting a broadcast check before you sell a single ticket, and this is predominantly football, of over $50 million. And there, in order to sustain all of the other things that depend on that football, you really have to have a mostly full stadium. Because, you know, if you sell 105,000 tickets, that pays for a ton of things. I think at the high end, some of this depends on how you just financially account for donations. But for a Power 5 school, it's might be around 50-50, maybe a little bit 55-45 for revenue that you generate on game day. And for smaller schools, it's going to tilt even farther away from television. Once you get to the FCS level, or once you get to maybe like a WCC school, there's very, very little television. Most of Division I, outside of the Power 5 and like multi-bid basketball conferences, basically don't make any money from television. They might even lose money from television. So there it's all from NCAA tournament distributions, ticket sales, donations for ticket sales, all of that kind of stuff.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Makes it hard. So what, I mean, let's say doomsday scenario, they don't have college football. I agree with you. They're going to figure out a way to do it. It's the same reason why the NBA, the MLB, and NFL will figure out a way, right? There's just too much money sitting around to not do it. But let's say they say we're going to take a year off from college football. Is that like, does that destroy a two dozen football programs more? Does it destroy all spring athletics at some of these schools? I mean, we've already seen a couple of schools drop a few spring sports and rumors of other schools considering it. So what does it do to the sports, college sports landscape if they theoretically took a year off?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. So here's what folks have to consider, right? Like, this is not something that's happening in a vacuum. So if you are a university president or somebody that works in American higher ed, for many schools, the last decade has not been particularly kind because you have two other trends that are happening along with this. You have, if you're a public institution, your school is probably making less money from state government over the last decade, right? If you are a state government and you're trying to balance your budget, you are often constitutionally prohibited from cutting revenues for Medicaid, cutting revenue for state prisons or for K-12 education, depending on your state constitution. So one of the only places where state government has discretionary spending is generally in higher ed. And so most states have been cutting the amount of money that they send to those schools, even especially smaller regional schools, but even big flagships too. You're also looking at a world where most universities are seeing their enrollment decline. Our country is not producing as many domestic college students going to four-year institutions. It's becoming more expensive and more difficult to recruit international students to fill that gap. So, you know, BYU is kind of protected from this somewhat, but if you are a Southern Utah or if you're a Kent State or if you're a small liberal arts school, you're already in a financially precarious position, and you're going to be suffering a lot from the COVID-19 fallout over the next couple of years because next year enrollment is probably going to crater. So if you have that landscape plus this devastation of potentially not having a football team for a year and not getting the broadcast and ticket sale money, then, yeah, I think it's a financial apocalypse. And we can all sit here and say, like, hey, you know, school, maybe if you hadn't bought that waterfall in the locker room, or maybe if you hadn't paid the head coach of a crappy team $2.5 million, you wouldn't be in this spot. And I think it's very fair to say a lot of Division I teams have wastefully spent some of their money. But this is something I don't think anybody could have really properly planned for. And it's I mean, we're already seeing Division II and Division III teams completely close. I think there are a couple of smaller D1 schools that are legitimately at the risk of closing, not losing a football team, but like not being a school anymore. And so if we went an entire fiscal year without football, yeah, I would say anybody in the G5 is going to most teams in the G5 are going to really be in a very, very difficult spot. And I would imagine Olympic teams from a lot of Power 5 schools would be cut in that scenario. It would be very bad.
So let's shift this over to BYU, Matt. So every 3 to 4 months, it seems like somebody at the Tribune or the Deseret News or somewhere decides to publish a piece that is usually titled "Why Now Is the Right Time to Get Back into the Mountain West Conference."
Oh, I know where we're going here.
Okay, yeah. So this just happened in the Des News, and I'm not trying to bag on the reporter or anything. You know, both you and I, you do it right now, and I did it in the past. I know you do these pieces, and sometimes you may not even fully believe them, I guess. But you know, I read that article, and it's basically like, with the COVID-19 and maybe a truncated football season, now is the time you would be better off in a conference. Convince me if I'm wrong, but I think that it now would be absolutely the worst potential time for BYU to join a G5 conference of a bunch of schools like a Boise State, who is furloughing their coach for 2 or 3 weeks, which isn't that big of a deal, actually. Saves them $50,000 or whatever. But, you know, am I wrong? Is this the worst time? Doesn't matter? It was the worst time already. This doesn't make it any better or worse? Or what's your take on BYU's standing as far as for this particular, you know, COVID-19 scenario, being independent versus being in the Mountain West Conference or Conference USA.
Yeah, I read that piece too, and I'm with you. Like, I don't think that idea has a whole lot of merit before this crisis, but you're absolutely right. This would be the worst time in the world to do it, right? If we're looking at a world where even BYU is going to face this at least a little bit of unparalleled financial uncertainty within higher education, why on earth would you get rid of a lucrative television deal with ESPN, the entity that also owns most of the bowl games, to jump to a league that nearly collapsed 6 months ago when Boise State, you know, had to sue the conference, and your flagship program is already like on the record as being very unhappy, and where the bottom part of this league, I think, would be at risk of potentially losing D1 membership or FBS membership if there's no football. Like this, it would be crazy. If I understand the author's argument correctly, this idea of we need to jump now because we don't know what a COVID-19 truncated season schedule might look like. BYU could announce they're joining the Mountain West tomorrow, and they're not playing the Mountain West in 2020. That wouldn't be able to happen for another 2 years anyway. So no matter what's happening, if we have a truncated season, BYU's schedule is going to look weird. But yeah. I'll tell you what. Stanford would much rather play BYU at the end of the season than almost anybody else in the Pac-12, because even if there's a pandemic, BYU fans are going to show up in that stadium and they're going to buy Stanford tickets and they're going to make more money that way. If you are Boise if you are a Power 5 team that's playing BYU in October or November, you'd rather have that game. ESPN would rather have those games. Like we can talk here to our blue in the face about the merit of that particular argument in a normal college football season, and we can talk about, you know, why BYU made this decision and why things are the way that they are. But I would think that trying to join a league with schools that may not be on the strongest financial standing in the near future does not make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, the argument that works in that whole independence versus conference deal is the aesthetics, right? I mean, playing in a conference, playing for a conference championship, it resembles what almost everyone else in college football does, right? So the aesthetics are more pleasing to a lot of people. You know, in the 80s when there were 20 independent schools or whatever the number was, that was different, right? But now you've got a handful and most of them are weird, right? Besides BYU and Notre Dame, that they don't want to be independent. They're independent not by choice, right? So it's a weird dynamic, but outside of that argument, the financial stuff is pretty clear, right? I mean, and like you said, in this particular case, but let's talk about, obviously BYU is a little bit of a black box when it comes to finances, but you know, out in the West in general with the Pac-12, who BYU is obviously actually pretty closely aligned with, right, from a scheduling standpoint, several games per year, the WCC, some of the Mountain West we already talked about, but how does this affect football and college sports out in BYU's neck of the woods?
Yeah, this would be, you know, in different regions of the country, I think the financial situation for these schools is different. You know, I would think in the Northeast there might actually be like the strongest financial risk exposure, given how small a lot of these schools are and how many students are being exported from that area. So for one, if we look in the Pac-12, at the smaller end of the revenue scale, your Oregon State, your Washington State, your Cal's, some of these schools made pretty ambitious capital projects over the last couple of years, like Cal Stadium renovation, Olympic sport facility construction in Oregon State and Washington State, big coach buyouts. And they did those things, you know, in part because they felt like they had to in order to be competitive, but also because they had projections from what the Pac-12 network was likely to send them, you know, back in 2012. And obviously those projections never hit. And now we have a recession coming up and we have some state appropriations and donations drying up. And so, like, I don't think, you know, Oregon State's not going to close, but they're in a much more challenging financial position than they were 8 or 9 years ago. And it's not entirely clear how that really rebounds. Like, this is not a school that's going to drop $4 million on a football coach anymore. And that's true, I think, for probably a third of the Pac-12. And that's definitely true for a lot of Mountain West institutions. You know, like as we talked about here before, these are schools that are certainly not self-sustaining by any measure that I think you and I would talk about. They're not and they depend on some state appropriations. They depend on donors And in the Mountain West, and especially as we get closer to like New Mexico and Texas, some of those donors work in oil. And oil is going to be – looks like it's going to be trading at a – you know, $15, $12 a barrel, you know, basically a fast food value meal for another month and a half. And if, you know, oil in the Permian Basin is going for $15, nobody in West Texas or, you know, near Texas Tech or New Mexico or Oklahoma, no one's there is going to have any money to go cut a big check. And those states that depend on petrochemical tax revenue to fund their universities, or in Nevada, if you depend on gaming, they're gonna be in a really tight spot. So I would worry a lot about any school in the West that is tuition dependent, which unfortunately are a lot of the really small WCC schools, or about any public school that's in a less diversified local economy, whether that's resource extraction, whether that's gaming, whether that's hospitality or tourism, because those are the schools that I think are going to be in a difficult position. And what I think BYU is going to find in the West is that there's going to be a lot of pressure in Olympic sports to minimize travel as much as possible. So if a team had to fly to get to Provo to play BYU baseball, or to do it for a gymnastics meet or for volleyball, I don't think that's coming. So I would imagine future BYU schedules are going to have a lot more bus trips. And there's probably not a ton of places you can really bus, right? But I would imagine you're going to see a lot more in-state opponents. You're going to see some Nevadas and, you know, northern Arizonas and places you could potentially drive to within 4 or 5 miles. And outside of football and maybe men's basketball, I would be shocked if you're going to see a lot of, you know, West Coast or Midwestern or Southern opponents, because no one's going to have the money to do it.
Yeah, and that's a problem for BYU, right? Because their membership in the West Coast Conference, or in a couple other sports, some West Coast based conferences like men's volleyball, most of their opponents are California schools, right? So yep. I could see a very weird season. And, you know, BYU volleyball got obviously robbed of an opportunity to potentially contend for a national championship. And next year they may be in a similar boat, just because they can't get enough premier matches, right, against the best schools to get into the tournament and all that stuff, because who knows what men's volleyball is going to look like. There's only, 40 schools anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I would feel comfortable in guessing you're probably not going to get Hawaii on there. Your trips to Columbus or to Chicago to play Loyola, or, you know, some of these powerhouse Midwestern programs, you're right. Like, it's not going to happen. And you're here in Chicago, I could get in my car and I could drive in a 50-mile radius and I can get to, you know, 15 Division I institutions. Yeah. But if you're in Colorado or Arizona or Utah, or I think in the Intermountain West or the Great Plains, you might really be in a pickle. And that might mean that you're going to have to play some teams. And there might be a lot of UVUs in your future and everything. And that is not ideal for RPIs or for a lot of other metrics.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has been kind of a downer, Matt, because it's COVID-19.
I'm sorry.
So no, it's all right. I asked the questions. I could ask you about your favorite sports movies of all time. It probably would have been not as much of a downer, depending on your sports movie picks. But let's end out on something good. So out of the NFL draft, you're an Ohio State guy, right? You love the Buckeyes. So I thought one of the best stories of the draft was you get this quarterback that's chosen, right, first overall, who's a transfer. And I just want to walk through, like, your Ohio State's current coach, you know, and nothing against Urban Meyer, though, of course, I hate him because, you know, I'm a BYU guy and I hate his guts. Yeah. But he came off as this terrific dude, right, because of his relationship with people who have left Ohio State, gone on to be very successful. And so I would, as a fan of Ohio State, I mean, what's that like, having a coach like that? I mean, obviously, having people leave the program who are talented, it's never good, but it just happens. It's part of college sports, is as somebody decides they get a better chance to play elsewhere. What was that like on, I don't know if you watched the draft and saw some of that, but I thought that was kind of a cool story, which I don't particularly, as a Purdue guy, like Ohio State that much anyway. So I wanted to not like the story, but I found myself liking it anyway.
Yeah, Ryan Day is a very interesting change of pace here, I think, for Ohio State, because college football coaches generally are famous for being control freaks and for being very, you know, narrowly focused and intense. Generally not people that I think you would consider, broadly speaking, normal. I don't mean that pejoratively. This is just a very intense, you know, high pressure kind of profession. And so people tend to, you know, I think that's why people are drawn to somebody like Mike Leach, who clearly has interest outside of football, even though he says things that are sometimes problematic and dumb, because he's not, you know, he's not Kirby Smart, right? Like he's not a boring straight ahead guy. Urban Meyer, you know, good and ill, I would not classify as normal in this. Like if you asked Urban Meyer about like, what was the last movie that he saw? Or if you asked Urban Meyer who the vice president was, he'd have to think about it for a little bit. Because if you wanted to talk about punters for 20 minutes, and I have, like he'll gladly talk about that. But what's interesting about Ryan Day, more so than I think any Ohio State football coach in my lifetime, certainly, is how normal he appears and how grounded. And people who know him a little bit better than I have said that. And I think that's a nice emotional transition from, especially the way that the Urban Meyer era ended at Ohio State.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, you know, obviously from a human perspective, but it makes good business sense for Ohio State to do this too. Like people transfer from Ohio State all the time, just because you recruit at that level and you can only play 22 guys or, you know, 25 guys in a rotation in some spots. And so a lot of people who are Ohio kids or who are mid 4-star recruits are going to go elsewhere, and a lot of them have productive careers. And that was, you know, that's the case for Burrow. And I've been following Burrow for a while because he, you know, he's from Athens,
right?
Which is, you know, west where Ohio University is. It's a small town, not too far from where I grew up in Ohio. Our high schools played each other, and you know, he was a 4-star kid, but nobody predicted him to be perhaps the most productive college quarterback of all time. Ohio State wanted to keep him. You know, he was the backup. He got hurt, and that thing was when he fell down the depth chart. But he was behind Dwayne Haskins, who was also a first-round pick and the most prolific passer in Ohio State history, and Justin Fields, who is maybe the favorite to – or one of the two favorites to go in the top five in the NFL draft next year, the best quarterback in the Big Ten, and maybe one of the top three remaining in college football now too. Took Ohio State to the playoff. So, you know, it's not like Burrow left because he couldn't beat out some scrubs. I mean, he went there and he got good coaching and he changed his body a little bit and did really well. And if you're in a place – if you grew up in a place like Ohio, and I think Texas is kind of like this too, where football is such a huge – on every level is such a dominant cultural force that unless the guy went to Michigan, if he's an Ohio kid, you're happy for him even if he didn't go to Ohio State, because you still look at him and say, you know, he's one of us.
Yeah. Yeah,
so, I know, especially that he's going to be playing for the Bengals, you know, unfortunately for him, but, you know, fortunately for an Ohio fan, he's an easy guy to root for. He's interesting. He has a personality. He's from a part of the state that doesn't produce a whole lot of players. He said nothing but good things about Ohio State. Ohio State said nothing but good things about him, and I hope he has a long and productive NFL career, because heaven knows Bengals fans could really use that.
Well, for sure, Well, you know, no one's going to feel bad for Ohio State on the quarterback side of things. Like you said, over the last few years, you've had a pretty good run. And heck, what you said about Burrow, nobody would have believed you 12 months ago that Burrow was going to be that prolific, right? I remember
wasn't
talking.
That good?
Yeah, he's a junior. He was pretty mediocre. And I remember, you know, Matt, my brother, follows LSU because he lived there for a little while. And there was, you know, talk last spring of whether he'd even start. Right. And the coaches said it was nonsense, but at least among fans, right, and boosters, there was, well, this may not be the guy, right? And even among their own fan base. So interesting story. Well, Matt, I know you've got your new newsletter. Why don't you tell us about that and how folks can follow you and get some of your perspective on college football?
Sure. So, you know, unfortunately, I was furloughed from SB Nation recently. I've worked there for 7 years, and it's given the uncertainty around the sports industry, I'm not really sure where I'm gonna formally land on my feet. So I've been pushing this project that I started last year called Extra Points. It's a newsletter that writes about the off the field forces that shape what we see on the field in college football. So if you're interested in higher ed finance, You know, if you might be, if you're listening to this podcast for this long, if you're interested in some of the state or federal, you know, political developments that are impacting college football with name, image, and likeness, and with your transfer policy that's happening right now, if you're interested in how population demographics or religious affiliation shape recruiting, and you know, all of these forces that and college football history that play such a huge role in who's good and who's not, I think you'd like Extra Points. Now, you could subscribe for free and get 2 issues a week. It's mattbrown.substack.com, or you can find it on Twitter at mattbrownep. You can also subscribe, and that gives you 4 issues a week. You know, there was a paid issue today that I reached out to a conference commissioner at the D2 level, and we talked about how oil prices impact athletic donations. That is $7 a month or $70 a year. And then you get a lot of college football stuff in your inbox, and you help me buy chicken nuggets for my kids. So you can feel pretty good about that. That's Extra Points. I think you might like it.
And chicken nuggets are delicious, depending on
my 5-year-old certainly thinks so.
Yeah. Every 5-year-old, I think, thinks chicken nuggets are delicious. I don't know what it is, but it's fairly universal. Well, thanks, Matt, for coming on. This was fascinating. It's great to get your perspective and how plugged in you are to these issues. And I'm with you. There's going to be college football this year. I just don't know what it's going to look like, but there's just too much money. So, anyway, well, thanks for joining us, and we'll have you on again sometime in the future.
Okay, that sounds good. Hopefully we can discuss something a little bit less apocalyptic next time.
Yes, yeah, I would certainly hope so.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, Matt, what do you got? It's your turn for the opening.
I feel like I showed up unprepared.
That's because I didn't tell you that it was your turn for the opening.
Until right now.
We don't need an opening.
Yeah, but this isn't even the opening. Didn't you just finish an interview with Matt?
No, yeah, that
not,
is correct.
Not me, but the other Matt?
The other Matt, which is confusing because there's lots of Matts.
It's a very popular name.
Yeah, on my team at work, we've got 2 Michaels and 2 Chrises.
Did you go to last name basis?
We have gone to last name basis on both.
Yeah, every time.
On the Michaels and the Chrises.
Every time I end up on a project or on a team with multiple Matts, at the very first meeting, everyone's like, there's like 3 Matts in here, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, just call me Mangum. That's it. Just don't even call me Matt anymore. Everybody, yep. And you, like, your last name is Smith. You're going Smith, like, whatever the last names are. And people are like, oh, that's very clever. I'm like, were you never in junior high?
No, apparently they weren't. We also have a Kate and a Katie on our team.
Not a clever solution. Kate and Katie is easy, though, if you can call one Kate and one Katie.
Yeah, they are definitely called Kate and Katie, but it does, on occasion, people get confused because people are dumb.
Right.
Which we just did. So let's speaking of dumb, I'm just kidding, Facebook tweetbag users. But let's jump into, let's just hop right into the tweetbag. We don't need an opening, like you said. We don't need an opening.
No, let's just climb on in.
This one came from Dave Broderick on Facebook, and if you want to hop on in the tweetbag, you can do that on Facebook at facebook.com/writingtheshot. And you are so juvenile. You wrote Adam Smells in the agenda next to Dave's question, and that's disrespectful to Dave and his question. So I chastise you for your disrespectfulness.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and be disrespectful to Dave Broderick for his question because of his hashtag.
Yes, I know. We'll get to that here in a second. So, assuming sports return, they will return. This is an assumption. Sports will return. But in the
can we just wait real quick, guys? Like, everything's going to, like, we're going to get this stuff back, guys. This is a temporary situation.
Yeah,
this will get better.
The influenza epidemic there in the early, you know, 100 years ago, they didn't stop doing everything forever, right? We're not going to sit around, all of us, and just watch Netflix for the rest of our life.
As fun as that might be.
Sure, yeah. But in the new normal, he says, one sport is eliminated completely. Which sport would you choose to lose forever to the Rona? And by the way, I can't call it the Rona. Anyway, all right. Hashtag, it'd be baseball for him. Baseball. Baseball is definitely
without being able to use an apostrophe. That's just a tough.
I know, it's hard with hashtags.
Tough hashtag.
So, Matt, I don't know. What's it going to be for you?
This isn't even difficult for me.
Badminton?
Golf.
Oh, golf. Yeah. I'll, pro golf.
Major, I will give you something that's considered a major sport.
Yeah, golf.
I used to go to one golf event every couple of years. I never watched golf on TV.
I've fallen asleep to golf on TV before. It's good for that.
I can't even fall asleep to it. It's so boring, I have to change the channel and fall asleep to something else.
It's not even that interesting to you, huh?
Like, I play golf a couple times in my life.
In my life? I played golf with you.
I had a job for a while where I golfed as part of a work-related hazard. But I was never very good at it.
Never been a great golfer.
I have not golfed in years.
But and what you're saying is that professional golf goes away. People can still golf.
Sure.
It's just not going to be on TV. That's an easy one. I'm with you.
I think that's probably an improvement.
Because I was going to say like curling or something. I was trying to pick something because I'm not going to pick soccer because I enjoy soccer. And, you know, that would like destroy lots of people in the world, sports fans. Obviously, I'm not going to say baseball because baseball's the best. Football, I love football. Basketball, I love basketball. I am a hockey fan, so I wouldn't want to see hockey go away. Plus, it's way different than the other sports. It's kind of fun, you know, to have some variety, as it were. Golf. I like golf. I was going to say tennis because I am a tennis fan.
Golf is a solution here, guys.
Yeah, golf is a solution, or lacrosse.
Why did you have to go there?
Well, because do you watch lacrosse?
I watch college lacrosse. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't watch any lacrosse, so would be no loss for me.
I've got a high school child who plays lacrosse.
Yeah, but that's
there's a lot of lacrosse that happens in our house. All right. I don't watch professional lacrosse. Does anybody watch professional lacrosse? I watch college lacrosse.
Though. They have it.
Sure, they have it.
All right, so let's move on to Shane McDougald. He has three questions for us. What was the most shocking part of The Last Dance episodes 3 and 4? Anything with Rodman?
You know, I had forgotten some of the Rodman stuff, like that time he disappeared for 3 days.
Yeah. It's just Rodman. Just say the word. What's bizarre is Rodman.
Okay. I got a couple interesting things. This was all over Twitter, but the Danny Ainge and Michael Jordan playing a round of golf in between games 1 and 2 of a playoff series?
And
Ainge won some money off of Jordan?
The episodes are blending together. Was that in 3?
No, that was in 2. Maybe it was in 3.
They're all blending together.
Because I watched them all over the past 2 days.
Yeah, they're blending together for me.
I didn't start watching until Sunday. So
yeah, I didn't watch 1 and 2 when it came out. So, but just Robin, the Ainge thing is pretty awesome. And plus, the Ainge thing from when people were going on Twitter because he had looked bad in some of those clips and saying that he wasn't a good athlete.
He was an amazing athlete. Stop it.
Yeah, I mean, a better baseball player than Jordan.
Hey-o.
Oh, hey, shots fired. Anyway.
But, I'll tell you, the one thing that – and I had to pause, and you may have to go back for this. Mark Pope is in Last Dance. He's in it. He's in the background of a shot where the Bulls are getting ready to play. Was he on the Warriors at the time? The Bulls are getting ready to play the Warriors, and he's in the background. I think it was the Warriors. I mean, I have to Google this.
He's tall, so
I had to pause it. I went back and I paused it, and I'm like,
I missed it.
That is Pope, and I Googled it, and he was maybe it wasn't. I don't remember what team it was, but he was on that team that year. It was 100%. It was him. Pope is in there.
All right. Second question from Shane is, why did Matt name his new dog Zeus and not Spike? He had suggested Spike in honor of the bad gremlin. Probably because it's not 1980s whatever, and none of your kids have seen Gremlins, I'm guessing.
Well, actually, I think the gremlin's name was Stripe, and that was his original suggestion. But Spike was the name.
Oh, Spike.
Spike was the name they gave this dog. The dog was picked up as a stray in February and was put in an animal shelter. And then he was pulled out of that shelter in order to preserve his life and brought into a rescue organization. And they named him Spike because he has a natural mohawk.
Yeah, but Spike's the wrong – it's a bad name.
I don't know. The kids voted. We had a whole bracket. There were 18 names into a bracket. The kids voted. Zeus was clearly the winner.
And his middle name?
His middle name is Kyle.
Like Vannoy. So you've got Ziggy and Kyle.
Yeah, yeah. Kyle, as a first name, didn't survive the first round of the bracket.
Yeah.
But it was one. It was one of my childhood dreams to have one dog named Ziggy and one dog named Kyle.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. And then Shane's last question is, what day is it? I believe it's Tuesday. We usually record on Tuesdays.
Nobody knows anymore.
I don't know. Oh, look at you. You pop and open a drink.
I'll tell you, whatever day it is, I'm drinking one of these.
And I will join you, but with actual liquid that tastes good. Mm. Ah, all right. Keith Smith via email. And if you want to email the show, you can do that at riseandshoutpod@gmail.com. Keith has a question also on The Last Dance. Which BYU player, any sport, any season, plays Rodman in The Last Dance docuseries? I don't think – I can't – I've been looking at this question for like a couple hours. I still have no idea who I'd pick.
I came up with a pick in about 10 seconds.
Okay. All right. We'll get back to that in a second. Don't be scared. They will never hear this. I swear on the holy notebook, you will be protected. I don't even know what that is, Keith.
You should read the rest of his question where he starts to pontificate on.
Well, the not the first notebook. Half. There's some weird this stuff in there. It's very symbolic and hard to follow. Oh, he's talking about the Bible. Okay. I like the second half more, much happier. He's talking about the Bible,
he's
right?
He's talking about the Bible. I thought he was talking. So this is an Old Testament versus New Testament joke. That sailed right over my head because I've not seen the movie The Notebook, and I thought he was talking about the movie The Notebook, and I was like, the first half of that movie, there's like weird symbolic stuff in it.
Is he talking
about this, like Memento? I don't know what movie is he talking about.
Is he talking about The Notebook, or is he talking about the Bible? Now I'm not sure. Maybe he's talking about both. Because as a reminder, if you can't remember, Keith has sent us multiple questions about The Notebook, the movie. But it does work either way, I think, actually. There's some weird stuff in there. It's symbolic and hard to follow.
I just assumed he was talking about the movie.
I think he's talking about the Bible.
He's never quoted scripture in his questions before.
That is correct.
This isn't the first time somebody has referenced scripture in the tweet bag, and I'm not against it.
That's not true.
But I just assumed we were talking about the movie here, which I've clearly never seen. Well documented. My wife came on and vouched for that. I just assumed that's what we were talking about. I was like, oh, that first half of that movie's got some weird symbolic stuff. I guess I never knew.
No, it doesn't. I don't know. I saw it once a long time ago.
There's chicken kissing. I don't know.
Yeah. Open mouth pecks. So let's go back to the question, which is which BYU player, any sport, any season, plays Rodman in The Last Dance?
Yeah.
Who plays him?
Rafael Araujo.
Oh. All right.
That's what I went with, right?
And he's too muscular, though.
The reason I went there, though, right, is you go, like, and it's the 2003-2004 season. Where he was, I mean, he was a force. But he could be like, he could be a little bit. He had a little bit of a pop. He had a little bit of an edge to him, right? Like, so he gets a letter from the league in that season for decking a guard at Gerald blasting him from UNLV, and then about a week later, he gets this technical foul for putting his elbow in Andrew Bogut's head.
Which is, right? I mean, it's up there with me with Jason Veritek punching A-Rod as one of those moments that you shouldn't be proud of, but you totally are.
But he was a lot bigger than Rodman in terms of just size, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he played just shy of 300 pounds when he was at BYU.
That's what I'm saying. Body type, he's not a fit.
Not the same.
I see where you're at.
He was a scrapper, really talented basketball player, and just kind of marched to his own beat in terms of the BYU culture, right? And that was one of the things I got out of The Last Dance with how they handled Rodman in Chicago is like they just kind of
let him do his thing
because
he
was
18 rebounds.
That's right. And he was going to give that to you every night.
Every night. And he was going to kick a cameraman on occasion. So I thought of it this way. Let's cast someone who's totally not Rodman for the role. So a BYU player, any sport, any season.
There's going to be like 100 examples of that.
Yes, but I've got the best one. I win. Are you ready?
I think I know where you're going here.
TJ Haas.
Yes.
I think it's the perfect. I mean, he's kind of the right body type, actually.
Right. He's kind of gangly, like Rodman.
Right.
So,
but he's absolutely censored.
Yeah, yeah. He drops a few F-bombs, like Rodman. Yeah,
just the letter.
Yeah.
Oh, Haas just drops the letter.
No, no. Haas, the famous one, he dropped the letter this last time.
Haas is, to my knowledge, has zero. Parts his hair for a basketball game.
Parts his hair for a basketball game, and he hardly has any.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect fit.
It's a perfect fit. All right. So let's go past that question and past both the Old and New Testament and go to Simon has an email for us. I think this is his second week in a row in the tweet bag.
Streak.
If you are looking for a great BYU football game, watch the 2013 BYU Texas game. Taysom and Jamal run all over Texas while Kyle Van Noy and Daniel Sorensen shut down the Texas offense. I love it when number four is healthy, is the hashtag. That is a great game if you're going to go back and watch it.
It is a great game. Fantastic game.
That was the I put these questions in the wrong order.
Noodles?
Yeah. Well, I'm not TJ Haas. I'm not going to swear on the podcast. who do you take me for? I'm not dropping F-bombs.
Your expletive is noodles?
I don't know. I was trying to think of something silly.
So I'm going to tell a quick story about you. Can I tell a quick story right now? Feel free to edit this out when we're done. And if you're going to fix something in the agenda, go ahead and do that while I tell this story.
I'll do that.
So Adam's playing basketball in high school, and he's in a game, and he goes up. I don't know. I have no idea what the circumstances were of the game or whatever. I just remember this part of the story. Adam goes up for a layup and gets fouled, and it's a hard foul, which was not hard. It's a hard foul. So when he comes down and says, "Jiminy Cricket," and the ref stops and is like, "What did you just say?" And he's like, "Jiminy Cricket, that guy just hit me," or whatever. And the ref's like, "I should give you a technical foul for saying that because it is so ridiculous."
All of this is true. It was in a blowout game and I wanted to score and I thought my best chance was driving to the hoop and I went hard and got hammered. And they did not call it because these are high school refs that just wanted to be done with this lousy game where we are by 25 or 30 points. So they didn't call it. And he did. And he started laughing the entire way down the court as I'm running back on defense. He just is about to fall over laughing, because he didn't. He thought that was ridiculous. All right.
I wonder how we would have reacted to noodles. Anyway, go ahead.
Randy Whittle on Facebook had another question about The Last Dance. He said, "The best thing going on in sports TV right now is The Last Dance. Assuming you've been watching it too, what have you found to be the most interesting aspect of looking back at MJ and the Bulls 90s dynasty?" So, Matt, what's something interesting you've found watching The Last Dance?
I think for me, it's the Jordan Pippen relationship is probably the number one thing. And to hear Michael Jordan today talk about Scottie Pippen and how much he meant to him as a teammate and in terms of his development as a basketball player. That, to me, has been fascinating. And the other thing that's really stuck out to me is this. Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player of all time. And there are some things to be learned about how to be great at your craft based on some of what you can learn about the way that he approached his game during that stretch of time where they were just so dominant.
What I've found to be interesting is two things. The first is, he seems a lot less bitter now in these interviews he's done recently than when he gave his Hall of Fame speech. Remember that? It just seemed like he was ticked off still about something, and I'm not even sure what. He seems much more reticent, much more likable, and much more, believing that he could... believing that, the stuff about Pippen, right, and some of the other things I just have found, to be very pleasant, I guess is the right word. The other part that I found fascinating is he was not the easiest teammate to play with,
no.
I should say.
No, he was not.
He was tough. He didn't understand people that did not want to give their all, and I think that goes back to what you said with Rodman. Rodman was a bizarre dude, right? But when he was on the court, there was no doubt what he was going to do. And so he was dependable, he worked hard, and he was really good at what he did. And Jordan could work with that. What he couldn't work with was the people that weren't fully dedicated to basketball. Right.
And what's interesting is even when Rodman wanted to take that 48-hour vacation, right? Which I don't think anybody – I think Phil Jackson is the only coach in the history of the league that would have gotten out of Rodman what he got out of Rodman during that stage of Rodman's life. Like the Detroit – and I think the Detroit phase, he was a little bit different, and he probably had the right coach for that phase too. But both Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan's ability to understand that that's what you needed to do to keep this guy in the right zone, like that's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. So, all right, that was the last of the last dance for this week. Justin Sweeney makes an appearance.
Sweeney!
You can tweet at us at BYU_RiseShout. He's at Justin D. Sweeney. Not sure it's awesome because I asked for awesome tweetback questions, but any thoughts on how this pandemic will affect future movie releases? Matt Brown and I talked a lot about how it's going to affect the sports world. A few already have gone straight to streaming because we can't go to the theater. Is there a price point they can get it to and still make money but release movies straight to my Apple TV? The answer is no. There isn't a good price point.
No, they can't make money doing that.
They can make money. They just can't make what they would make in the theaters. You know, I don't know when we're going to go back to seeing movies in the theaters. But we have rented two movies for $20.
In the state of Texas, you can go back to seeing a movie in theater this weekend.
Okay.
Kansas, but they're only allowed to sell... They're only allowed to sell 25% of the seats.
Yeah, that's what AMC, before the state of Kansas and most of the country forced movie theaters to shut down, that's what AMC, because I'm part of their, you know, StubHub MVP club or whatever, VIP. And
they still have that stuff? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I pay a monthly fee and I get to go to the movies as much as I want.
Which you're a movies guy, so it makes sense for you.
Yeah,
okay, great.
Yeah. So they had said they were going to sell it at some level of capacity, right? And I think, you know, that's probably what's going to happen first. But you're going to have a lot of, number one, there's fewer tickets, right? And you think about the big weekends of big releases. The only way they can make the money is if they convert half their theater to the movie, right? Which sometimes they do anyway. But you know what I mean? The other part is, we did Trolls World Tour for $20, and we did Onward, and it was going to be on Disney Plus like a week later, but I just kind of felt like, you know, I know Disney doesn't need the movie, but all the people working on the movies need the money, right? I should say Disney doesn't need the money. They need the movies to make money. So we did that. I mean, I've got a kid that's like obsessed with Trolls, and it was cute, the second one.
And we did both of those same two movies, but that for me, it was mostly like, we just got to do something to keep these kids sane.
Well, yeah, and it's cheaper than taking families our size to the movies.
Oh, right? My gosh.
But they would need to charge. The problem is you can't price it right? This is the same thing with pay-per-view. Like when I was a kid and was into boxing, I'd go over to my friend Frank's house and we'd all chip in, pay for pay-per-view would be like $60-$70. But there were six of us, right? So $10. It's like a movie ticket, right? It wasn't a big deal. But if I was by myself, as a teenager, I was not gonna spend $70, right?
Right.
So they made, you know, by us getting Trolls, they made less money than we would have. Though maybe that's not true, because, you know, the movie theaters are the ones that are getting really hosed. Right. But yeah, they're not going to make as much money. So I think movie releases are going to be pushed back and keep getting pushed back. But there'll be a bunch because there's just too much volume. There's going to be a bunch. I mean, heck, Disney just put their new kind of kid spy supernatural adventure one. Artemis Fowl is going straight to Disney Plus. Right. There'll be some of those because there's just too much volume. Right, you're gonna see kind of those second tier, third tier movies from a financial standpoint, not quality, go out through streaming services because they got to clear the they've got to clear the inventory because there's gonna be a backlog when they finally go back to full strength in the movie theaters. All right, you can be a Patreon supporter of this podcast, Matt. Well, not maybe you. That would be weird. But those of you that listen, go to patreon.com/riceandshout and support the podcast, help us pay the bills. Ivory Dental, do you know who that is, like the person?
I'd have to look that up. I don't know who that person is. Yeah, I actually meant to look that up.
But they said, go buy yourselves a couple of hot dog sandwiches. They're our newest Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much. I spent the entire dinner hour debating this topic again with my family.
I don't even understand what the debate is.
It's not a sandwich, but it doesn't matter. All right. John D. Jensen has a question for us regarding Mr. Taysom Hill. You just signed a $21 million contract. What's your first purchase? Does Taysom's new contract make it more or less likely he's the heir to Drew Brees? So let's stick with the first one. You just got a $21 million contract. What's your first purchase?
I'm going to go buy a car.
Fancy car or just like a new nice car?
Just a new nice car.
Hmm. What is my first one? Probably a car.
I mean, but really what I would probably do is like pay off the mortgage.
Put it in a, put it in a 401k.
Figure out a way to invest it wisely. I probably wouldn't. I'm not going to go hog wild, but that's just me. But that's not a fun answer to the question. I'm going to buy a helicopter or a tank. That's way more fun. I watched a thing today. There's a series on, I think it's on Netflix, The Toys That Made Us. They did an episode on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles franchise.
Yeah. That's a great franchise. Great. And so TV series.
Eastman and Laird, right, when they signed their first licensing deal and everything started to really take off, they both got checks for like $1 million. And one of them went out and bought a tank.
Oh my gosh, people are so dumb.
Yeah. Anyway, but that's the more fun answer, right? Okay, you go ahead. You probably have a fun answer.
I don't. I'd buy a vacation house.
There you go. A nice that's a place fun answer.
To go out of the way, probably in the woods somewhere on a lake.
Yeah. Nice.
In like Idaho or Minnesota or maybe the Dakotas. You
lost me at the Dakotas, but this sounds
South
nice.
South Dakota is fantastic.
I'm not sure I've ever been there.
The Black Hills are one of the greatest places on earth. Badlands, Black Hills. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I keep telling Kathleen we're going to retire there, and she says I'll need a new wife to do that, so probably we won't retire there, I would guess. Does Taysom's new deal make him the heir apparent to Drew Brees? Kind of. I believe more now than before.
But they signed Winston the same day.
Yeah, but Winston's just there to be the backup this year. They signed him to a one-year deal. Nobody believes that Winston is their future franchise quarterback.
No, and I get it. And Winston's only there. He's there in case if Drew goes down, Winston's going in.
Yeah, it's just
like what they did with Bridgewater, right?
Yeah.
And Winston's just doing that to get a little bit of film so he can go sign somewhere else, just like what Bridgewater did. But I just feel like that if Taysom were the heir apparent, and I know that Sean Payton loves doing with Taysom the stuff that he's doing now, but I feel like if he were the heir apparent, they just you pull him out of that stuff and just give him the reps at quarterback.
But they're trying to win now. Know. They're trying to win now. You see, I hear what you're saying, and I think I've thought the same thing over the last 2 years, but then I just started thinking about it when they signed him to all this. I mean, this is like the second biggest free agent contract that was signed.
$16 million guaranteed. I mean, it's a lot of money.
Not the second, but it was one of the biggest, right?
For two seasons?
Two seasons, right? So you look at that and you go, why do you do that? Right? Because you didn't have to pay him that much. He probably would have taken less. You could have just given him the minimum of that tender, which was, I think, $5 or $6 million for 1 year. But they're trying to win now, and this is the year. I mean, it's all this year because Brees is going to eventually turn into a pumpkin. And then you got to not start over, but it is going to be a transition. But why do you give him the 2 years and all that guaranteed money unless you're saying, hey, we're going to make you the guy after Brees retires next year? And this way you have him, and if Brees decides to give it one more year after this year, you got Hill for both those years. I don't know. It's the dollar value shocked me, so it makes me think they're valuing Taysom Hill in a different way potentially than we think they are. Or they just paid him too much money above his market value. I don't know which one. All right, Wade Hillam has a question about basketball. So we've got two Matt Harms questions.
Awesome.
All right, so Wade says this. My biggest beef, and I'm going to summarize here because this is a long one, is his biggest beef with BYU basketball has been that we've struggled to recruit big men over the last several years. And I'm not exactly sure what that means because we've had in Yoeli Childs and why can't I think of his name? Ivan Drago. That's not his name, but that's who he looks like. Why am I doing this blanket thing?
Eric Mika? Who are you
talking? Mika. Why can't I think of Mika here for a second? We've had
I was going to say Andre Kirilenko when you said Ivan Drago. Andre, that's Andre where I went Kirilenko. First.
No,
that's all over the place.
Ivan Drago, he's just from Russia.
What are you talking about?
So you look at that, and those are two of the best big men BYU has ever had. Okay? So I'm not exactly sure this narrative is true. And before that, you had Brandon Davies, who was also really good. So I'm not exactly sure this is true. How many big men do you need at one time? Anyway, so now he gives a lot of credit to the coaching staff for getting Harms. Now we have five guys over 6'9", which may be a record for BYU. And, of course, we have two 6'10 coaches, he said, to help coach these guys. How do you think Pope and company will use all this hype? And Wade would personally love to see three of them on the floor at the same time quite often. I don't know if that is likely to be the case. I don't know.
Well, oh, that's happening.
Skill sets.
But that's quite gonna be often, a thing.
Though? I mean, it's going to be a thing. But are they going to start three guys over 6'10"?
They might.
6'9"? Well, I mean, some of their skill sets, I mean, a couple of those guys can shoot from outside, right? So
exactly.
So I don't know.
I think they're doing this on purpose, man. I think he has an idea of what he would like to do and how he would like to run this, and he needs these big guys for it. And getting guys with a little bit of this diversity in their toolbox, it seems to signal to me like we will see the three of them on the floor. I don't know what quite often means, right? But I think we're going to see it a lot.
So you and I both happen to root for Purdue in addition to BYU because we both did grad school there. You know, what do we expect to see from Harms? I mean, in a way, he was kind of a disappointment at Purdue, right? He never managed to be the player that everybody thought he would be. And heck, this year he was actually had a worse year than he had his sophomore year. So if you look at that, I mean, this is a big get for BYU, but this isn't a guy that's going to come in and average 20 and 10, right? He did not do that at Purdue. And unless Pope and them can transform him, he was kind of soft at Purdue. I mean, I like Harms and it's a great get for us, but like the season next year is better because of him, but he's not going to be what makes the offense go. I mean, he's going to block some shots though, you know, because that's what he does and get in some foul trouble.
Well, I think what you see from Harms next season is going to be better than what you saw from him last season. And, sure. And I want to believe that, that his shooting and things kind of go back to the way he was playing the year before, and then and then ramps up some. And I think having Pope around to coach him is going to make a difference. I think the way that he's going to fit in on this roster is going to be different than the way they were playing and using him in West Lafayette. And I think also the role he's going to play against some of the teams in the West Coast Conference is, I think, going to provide some opportunities for him that if he's prepared to step up, could be very good for him in his career.
Well, and you know, the Big Ten is a much more physical conference, right? And for a guy at 7'3" who weighs only 250 pounds, right, he's not a physical beast. I mean, I think what they need to do with him is use his strengths, which Pope is in 1 year has shown. And his time at UVU, an ability to leverage the strength of his players, right, and minimize weaknesses. And please just don't let him shoot threes. every time at Purdue. Every time he shot a three, I'm like, no. No, you're not a three-point shooter, dude.
That was never his thing. I don't know what that was all about, right?
Yeah, I mean, he shot a little bit more than one three a game. I don't want him seeing. He should take it every once in a while when he's open, wide open. And I mean wide open. Like, he could lay down and no one is close to him. And when he lays down, it's a long ways away because he's 7'3", right? All right. Let's go back to the agenda. Tyler Anderson, great news that Matt Harms is coming to BYU. I'm wondering how much his arrival changes your expectations for this upcoming basketball season. And from Zero to Demmer, how are you excited about him being a Cougar? I'm John Beck excited about him being a Cougar. That's a high level of excitement.
I kind of bought into the hype. I'm going to be honest. I think it changes, here's the reason I would say I'm at the top of the scale is I believe that this makes a material difference in how far this team is going to go next year. And I think they were kind of on the cusp and he's pushed them into kind of a new area of what I think they can accomplish. I think this is the one incremental piece that they've added that's going to help them kind of get to another level of results. So while I understand Matt Harms is not some world beater, but I think that adding that piece is going to make a big difference for the team. So for me, I'm towards the top of the scale. I'm Detmer. I'm super excited about Matt Harms coming.
Detmer? Wow. I'm not Detmer level excited, but
I think that this team now, when I look at what we're about to put on the court, and again, I see him as like this was the last ad. I think it might get them another. It could give them another win, another tournament win.
I think it could be worth
an additional tournament win.
So you and I talked about this like midseason that I thought even with Jesse Wade eligible next year that I thought this team was going to take a big step back.
Yeah,
like enough of a step back that like tournament was going to be they were going to be a bubble team, right?
Right.
I don't think that's true anymore. I think they won't be as good as last year, but I think they make the tournament.
That's right. And that's exactly what I'm saying. I think they were a bubble team, but I look at what they've put together now. I think they're a one-win tournament team.
Okay. I'm a little less bullish on them than you are, but I hear what you're saying.
And we're going to beat Gonzaga.
So he asks us, and this will be our last question. I also wanted to ask you guys to each pick two current or former BYU basketball players to play with you on a 3-on-3 team. So, Matt, I've been thinking about this a lot since I read Tyler's question. Did I say it was Tyler Anderson's question? I did say that, right? If I didn't.
Maybe I did. I don't know.
He sent it via email. So, Matt, I've got my two. I can go first if you want, but.
Why don't you go first?
Okay, so I want the easy picks are like Jimmer and Ainge, right?
Yeah, which I'm not doing.
I'm not picking Jimmer, and I'm not picking Ainge because I'll never see the ball. And if I'm playing in there, I want to see the ball. So I'm picking Jackson Emery, one of my favorite BYU basketball players of all time, because there's no way I'm shutting down a really good player, and so we need Jackson Emery to do it, right? And we're taking me in my prime too, right? We're not taking 43-year-old Adam because that would be sad. Jackson Emery was pick number one for me. And then my other favorite like basketball player when I was a kid at BYU was Michael Smith. So I'm picking Jackson Emery and Michael Smith because they're two of my favorite players of all time. And we'd have three very different skill sets, you know, Smith could, but in 3-on-3, everybody's got to pass. Now, rebounding might be a little bit of a weakness for me, but everyone's got to be able to pass on 3-on-3 and be able to create their own shot, and both those guys can do that. And what do I bring to the table? Nearly nothing. But, you know, I still would love to play with either of those guys. And I could go on forever because I've got other people I'd love to play with. Matt, how about you?
So for me, I went a different route here. I went just fun. And because I'm terrible at basketball, I bring absolutely nothing to the table here. I can't handle the ball well. I can't shoot. I'm not tall. you know, so I like, if we're not going very far in whatever this fictitious tournament is.
No,
because I'm going to be an anchor on this party barge. So for me, this is completely this is just nostalgic.
Okay.
So I'm going back to the one player, BYU basketball player that I've referenced already in today's show,
Rafael Araujo.
I'm taking Rafael Araujo.
Okay, I didn't see that coming.
I enjoyed watching him play.
Yeah, it was fun to watch.
I liked his attitude. Maybe he was a little crazy. I don't know what he was. But I think people forget how good he was. You know,
yeah,
some time in preparation for this conversation about, you know, who would play Dennis Rodman or whatever, going back and looking at his stats. He was very good for us when he was there. And then the other guy, another guy that and he was there while I was there, right? So I saw him play. And another player that I loved watching play when I was at BYU is Mike Hall. And so that's the other guy I would take. And I know they played together, and I know these aren't from like some historically good BYU teams or whatever, but they were a lot. I really enjoyed watching these guys play. And so for me, it would be cool if I were to go play in a 3-on-3 tournament to play with these guys that I got to, that I enjoyed watching when I was.
Yeah. You took a very different tactic. I'm trying to win basketball games.
I want to have some fun and maybe watch Rafael deck a guy. I don't know.
Yeah. So the other players I considered for my team were Mika, because he's completely unselfish, right? You know, Mika would have been great to have on the team. I thought about TJ Haas or any of the Haases. I considered, heck, picking two Haases. That would be kind of fun. But I decided against that. And then another player that I just, you know, that I really liked as a kid, though I didn't see him play very much, was Devin Durant. So I considered him. And then the other one that obviously this is, you know, going way back in time, is to go back and get now I can't. I had his page up here and I dropped it. Why can't I think of the Croatian guy?
Krešimir Kosic.
Yeah, Kosic. What is wrong with my memory today?
I don't know.
So anyway, I thought, you know, something like that. I never saw him play, but he may have been the best basketball player BYU ever had, right? In theory. I don't know. There were a lot of choices. And obviously, playing with Jimmer would be kind of fun because I could just feed him and then I don't have to worry about scoring. But then what do I do, right?
Well, that's all I'm going to do is I'm just going to feed the ball to Araujo and let him just...
Araujo in the post and then get out of his way.
Pretty much. Or if we're having a hard time feeding him down low, then I'm just going to hand the ball to Hall. Like, I'm never going to shoot in this thing.
Yeah, you're never going to shoot, which is wise. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. We hope you enjoyed this show. Kind of a depressing start with Matt Brown because COVID-19 is not the feel-good topic, but we brought it home with some absolute ridiculousness here in the second half of the show, which I'm very proud of.
Great tweet bag questions. Really good stuff.
Well, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, and we will catch you next time.
Go Cougars!